The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, natural listeners, to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And Happy New Year to everyone. This is Dr. Z, your host for today. Dr. Kamai is in sunny Florida enjoying the vitamin D. And although I can't complain about how it's been the winter so far in the Northeast here, at least, and we're really excited to bring you another year of health, alternative medicine, and issues affecting your body, your mind, your cells, and yourself. And to start off the new year, right, especially from my perspective, we have Dr. Arthur Devani. And Dr. Devani is going to be talking about his book called The New Evolution Diet today. And he's a professor in the Department of Economics and the Institute for Math Behavioral Sciences at University of California, Irvine. He's author of 100 scientific articles and books, which have ranged from economics to astrophysics, social learning, artificial intelligence, evolution. Now, Dr. Devani, 73 years old, and you know, one of the things I'd like the listeners to do at one point is to go on his website at some point and look at pictures of Dr. Devani, because he is a living example of what he's going to be talking about today. And some people call him Superman, slightly fitter granddad, or the patriarch of the paleo movement. As a scientist and athlete, he is the creator of evolutionary fitness, an integrated model of paleo diet, fasting, and exercise. And he's going to be discussing his book, again, The New Evolution Diet, and his website is Arthur, A-R-T-H-U-R, Devani, D-E-V-A-N-Y, .com. He'll be giving that out a little later on. How you doing, Arthur? Happy New Year.
Oh, it's a great New Year, isn't it, Dr. Z?
So far, so good.
Pleasure to start it off on your show.
Great. So let's talk about this, you know, diets are such controversy. And, you know, I guess it's appropriate to do, we're Dr. Kamai and myself, we're planning on spending a lot of January talking about diet and lifestyle modification as people really try to make New Year's resolutions and stick to them and things like that. And, you know, hopefully people will be able to do so and not fail miserably. But nonetheless, you have a very interesting approach to diet. A lot of people would find it very controversial in the natural health sphere of things. Tell us a little bit about your journey and how your diet, exercise, and approach of life manifested in you.
It all began with my family. My son became a type 1 diabetic at the age of 2 when I was visiting at University of Chicago way back in the blizzard of 79. And I went on a quest to study metabolism and see what I could do to keep him healthy. I'm happy to say he is a very healthy 35-year-old. Many type 1 diabetics don't have children. They end up stunted in growth. He's 6'3 and has 5 children. So it seems to have worked out. And, of course, insulin is at the central role. It has a central role in type 1 diabetics. As you know, Their ability to secrete insulin is diminished or evaporates over time,
right,
largely by attack from the immune system. So I approached his issues, which later became my wife's issues, because she also became a type 1 diabetic, so there's a clear genetic connection there. Inflammation, carbohydrate metabolism, and how to use fat and other nutritional substrates as substitutes for carbohydrate. and the nature of exercise all became part of our arsenal for dealing with the diabetes. And the journey continued as I studied complex systems in my work on motion pictures and in evolution itself. It turns out there are many punctuated equilibria, as you know, that the climate changes and people have to adapt to that.
So that's punctualism versus gradualism, I guess.
It is.
Like a little debate on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there probably is, but the gradualists, well, I don't want to get into that.
That's another discussion.
So it all came together in about 1984 when I brought all that research together and began living a different way myself. It turned out that all the foods that we found caused an excessive requirement for insulin injections and put both my child and my wife in a glucose crises in the sense of so-called insulin reactions and the way the brain responds to that. It all came together and we started living according to how the testing dictated our diet, and it turned out that was pretty much a Paleolithic-like diet, which made me very comfortable because, after all, our genes for metabolism and so forth are quite ancient. In fact, the insulin gene goes back probably half a billion years, if not more. So realizing that if we led a sort of a relaxed, more natural life and ate the foods that were appropriate during our evolution, everything became so much easier. In fact, my wife was on such a low dose of insulin that some doctors refused to believe she was a diabetic. So it worked. It worked splendidly, and that work continued. And of course, I began to study different forms of exercise. I've been in a gym for about 60 years, having been a professional athlete and always taking care of my health and my body. So I combined the role of exercise and diet and mimicking sort of the intermittent fasting that we know our ancestors were exposed to. And, of course, modern research fully supports the view that intermittent fasting is healthy. Not calorie restriction, but periodic moments of caloric deprivation. It promotes a different body composition. And, of course, body composition is really a key to metabolic health. Most modern people tend to have what's called sarcopenic obesity, diminished muscle mass, and an excess of fat mass. That alters your metabolism profoundly. In fact, the severely obese are shown to have diminished brain mass as well in imaging studies. So what's happening is the fat, in a way, is kind of stealing nutrients meant for the brain, and the brain mounts an appropriate response to that by reallocating resources inside the body. Here's where being an economist helped a lot, because you can understand the allocation of scarce resources.
And then the fat becomes like an angry organ, and it releases these various angry inflammatory, mm-hmm, what they call those adipokines and cytokines and things like that, which I guess fuels inflammation and things like that.
It promotes inflammation, and the inflammation makes you insulin resistant, and that's an attempt, I think, one hypothesis is that's an attempt by the brain to redirect nutrients to itself because it's in an energy crisis during that those kinds of episodes.
But aren't we very different from... You mentioned Paleolithic. Listeners may not know. I mean, they kind of maybe have vague ideas of, our ancestors, whether going back to, I don't know if Cro-Magnon was an ancestor or not, although they are kind of realizing that maybe we have some genes in the Cro-Magnon pool. But certainly, early Homo sapiens, let's put it that way. Aren't we different from then, and aren't we living in a different world than back then?
We are, but all the adaptations in modern world had a very, very small incidence on genes and genetic expression. The key is that we harbor ancient genes, but we express them differently in the modern world than our ancestors did.
Oh.
By the way, recent analysis shows that Cro-Magnon, found 28,000 years ago, was sequenced, and genetically they're virtually indistinguishable from us. We have they were taller, had larger brains, they were more robust. We're just now attaining the height of Cro-Magnon, and our brains are about 10% smaller now than they were at that time, probably from the effects of civilization. You don't have to be as smart to live in a civilized, safe world.
What about Neanderthal? Do we have any Neanderthal genes and traits and things like that?
We do have traces of Neanderthal, and we all know people who we think...
It seems like a put down. It seems like a put down in society. You act like a Neanderthal, but nonetheless.
In truth, we all do just a little bit, but they were very cold adapted species, very successful species. They lasted 200 million years or something like that, 200,000 years or something.
But what about like with modern day pollutants? I mean, our ancestors weren't exposed to pesticides that mimic estrogens, plastic that mimics estrogens and messes up our body and forces our body to detoxify them, the onslaught of allopathic medications, lots of refined sugar in the form of corn syrup, even though the corn syrup industry, as you know, is trying to advertise that it's the same as sucrose. So why don't you comment a little bit about that, Arthur?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Now, our ancestors, of course, were exposed to a lot more worms and other creatures that we are not necessarily adapted to now. We have a safer food supply and what have you. And they were also subject to severe accidents and even mild starvation. It would have been intermittent, not chronic starvation, such as you see once agriculture begins. So really, the era ending about 10,000 years, 11,000 years ago, is and going back from there, is called the Old Stone Age, Paleolithic, and the New Stone Age starts about that time, although they had bronze and other things by then as well. So what we find is that we've inherited a very robust blueprint that got our ancestors through ice ages, major climatic changes, and we're geared to be healthy if we express our genes in these healthful ways. And all the things you mentioned, the toxins, and even the new forms of pathogens like the AIDS virus and so forth, are all somewhat recent innovations. I mean, the AIDS virus is traced back to the Congo, I guess you probably know better than I am, not that long ago.
Right.
And it's from humans invading territories they never occupied before, and of course slaughtering what they call bushmeat and eating the blood and so forth. So we're exposed to a host of broad new pathogens.
Challenges,
mm-hmm.
right?
The challenges, and our immune system is really trying to sort this out. And if your immune system is taxed by these things, plus you add the taxation imposed by excess body fat and the inflammatory burden that creates, and we're all slightly acidic to some degree as well. Even though blood acidity is fairly tightly regulated, you exhaust your ability to do that over time, and that's why old age homes have that acid smell to them.
Well, you know, you certainly catabolize your bones to try to buffer mm-hmm. things, you know, and I guess muscle too, like you mentioned, sarcopenia. You know?
Yes, right. You need the amino acids, and you go to the muscle to do it. So, paradoxically, you know, somebody who has really gained a lot of weight is, to some degree, relying upon the amino acids in their muscle to supply the complete amino acid profile that's often lacking in the diet.
Wow.
Can I just say that, you know, I haven't even had a cold in 30 years.
That's amazing.
Now, one aspect of it is my diet is low in inflammatory stress, and it also, which exhausts glutathione, the primary antioxidant in the cells.
But there's so many vegetarian groups, and I don't want to get too much, mm-hmm. In the quagmire here.
Right.
But, you know, let's say if you eat a lot of meat, it death begins in the colon, and If you don't digest the meat, it creates putrescines and cadaverines, and to a small extent, that's quite true. If you don't, there's a tremendous amount of pesticides and herbicides in meat and death hormones, and it's not sustainable, and to make a pound of beef takes so many resources on Mother Earth here that you're raping her, and there's a lot to say with a plant-based diet. So, and I know you're not advocating one or the other. You're basically saying this is the diet that our ancient peoples use, which it was a lot plant-based too. So you're not like saying all meat. I just want to make that clear to the listeners out there that may be confused. But can you elucidate on those points?
Yes, that's a very important point to make. The base of my food pyramid, if there is a food pyramid, I'm just drawing one because people are familiar with those things, basically starts with adequate hydration, that is good water, plenty of water, and then it starts with vegetables. I mean, the biggest, broadest portion of my food pyramid is vegetables, followed by reasonable amounts of low-fat meats and seafood. Remember, our ancestors got through the ice ages by crowding along the seashore, and freshwater fish at lakes in the Rift Valley and along the seashore of South Africa and what have you became a very crucial part of the diet 185,000, 200,000 years ago. And this is shown in Cro-Magnon, too, by the way, that skeleton, the analysis of the isotopes in the teeth does show that about half of the protein came from fish and about half from land-based animals. As to the world load that's imposed by agriculture, I think by far the greatest load there is actually caused by monoculture that is practiced in agriculture today. They destroy habitat for animals. They alter the streams with their high nitrogen fertilizers.
Right.
And it's a very complicated calculation to actually figure out what the caloric balance is relative to its environmental cost. I recognize that problem, and I recommend free range and fresh wild caught fish. The other side of it, of course, is the health burden that comes from one, excess meat consumption. Remember, animals were a fugitive resource. That's why we're smart and mobile. We had to follow the animals to exploit them, and that imposes a natural limit on the amount of meat and seafood that we do eat.
So feast or famine. If we had a kill or something like that, we would feast up on the meat. There weren't really refrigeration back then, so we kind of did what we could, and that was it. There may be a long period of time before there was another kill.
Yes, and there would have been intermittent periods where you had to subsist on something like 300 wild plants instead of animal foods because the animals are gone.
Right.
So if you take the intermittent fasting point of view, you're imposing an intermittent load on agriculture and its ability to provide meat. By the way, if you just look at an open plain and you look at the plants and the animals, you realize that all the animals are doing is converting the plants into something that's more concentrated in terms of healthy fats. I'm talking about now free-range animals, not the stuff that's raised, on feedlots. So, all in all, the fatty acid profile of free-range animals and wild animals is far superior to the fatty acid profile of, feedlot-raised cattle. In fact, they are sitting there eating basically the same kind of diet, corn and wheat and so forth, that we're exposing ourselves to, and that's how they fatten cattle.
Right, and then you're basically saying that it's those grains that are the big troublemakers in our diet.
I feel they are, and there's a new category of disease to some degree being developed now, which are called lectin diseases. Every plant just sits there, and its only defense is to poison the thing that's eating it or to deter its reproduction. there are some plants, if the locust eats certain plants, it affects gene expression so profoundly that their flight muscles of the larva never develop. So what you have is just an ingenious form of pesticides that plants that are grains develop. So grains have to defend themselves, and the way they do it is by having these lectins in there, which are proteins that interfere with function in the body in many, many, many ways, and also alter gene expression.
So, right, and there are many lectins that will both inhibit other function, like insulin function, and then there's some lectins that destroy red blood cells that make the gut create a lot of malabsorption. I mean, they can induce malabsorption in infants by giving them, soy formula, and it flattens the villi. I remember actually reading that paper when I was one of Dr. D'Adamo's residents. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you mentioned the lectin idea.
Well, moreover, they strip glycoproteins. They capture glycoproteins off the surface of the cell and open a way for pathogens to get in. So they're a participant. Remember, bacteria are much smarter than we give them credit for. You can see images of them moving in colonies and avoiding pathogens and sliding over to where the food is. They're very well organized and adaptive. And I think in some sense they have learned to use participation with lectins to and the stripping of protective mucosal lining, like you mentioned in the stomach, you develop a permeable gut.
Sure.
And then you have undigested foreign protein remnants, and that's the immune system says, what is this?
There's so many people with celiac and subclinical celiac. It's just a huge epidemic, I find. And some of my work is to, get people off of these, some of the grains.
Mm-hmm.
What about other grains, like, quinoa and some of the newer grains that were substantial for the Incas and some of the other cultures there?
Mm-hmm.
What's your feelings on those types of grains? Same type of thing, or?
Well, I tend to avoid them. It may be possible that they've altered the lectin composition in such a way that they're certainly more beneficial. That would be something that, somebody could try to establish. But they were actually rather short, and fierce, but short. And, of course, all their fighting was primarily over, scarce agricultural valleys and what have you. So agriculture promotes, because resources are fixed in location, agriculture tends to promote for warfare.
So when agriculture came around, I was reading some research that when agriculture came about, many diseases that we didn't really see in humanity began to get worse, like, for instance, autoimmune disease, and they can trace rheumatoid arthritis to, they know that T-Rex had osteoarthritis, but rheumatoid arthritis, where you're actually attacking our joints, attacking collagen fragments, really seemed to come more about around the genesis of agriculture. I remember reading that somewhere. Have you read that?
I have indeed, and it's very true. Lethal pathogens can't really survive out in the wild with scattered tribes. And in settled agriculture, you have a high load of pathogens. You have novel pathogens from crossover from animals to humans, like we still see coming out of Asia periodically.
Right.
The avian flu.
The bird flu, yep.
Mm-hmm. It provided a fetid and rich environment and a large enough population to sustain more lethal pathogens than could be sustained out in the wild. Now, some of these have crossed over and made their peace with us, so they're not as lethal as they used to be, because that's the survival strategy for the bacteria or the virus. Over time, we seem to accommodate to these things to a degree, but we end up with, diseases and viruses that were so rare that now have become a challenge. We can get pneumonia from a prisoner in a Russian prison who was let out of prison one day and shows up in Miami the next.
Right. That's a real challenge to our immunity, that's for sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about your diet and what you're eating and what would be like a typical New Evolution diet, the title of your book.
Well, let's start with this morning. I took the family and our grandchildren out to dinner last night. And by the way, the two children who almost never eat this sort of thing have developed fondness for prime rib, much to my, the damage of my expense account. But I never eat everything that's on the plate if I feel even slightly full. So I brought home a little bit of the prime rib and some leftover spare ribs, and I eat spare ribs galore. The barbecuing leaches a lot of the fat out of the ribs. So I had leftover prime rib and a few ribs, and then I had cantaloupe. I started it with the cantaloupe and a fresh pear, and then that was it. That little coffee was my breakfast. For lunch today, I probably won't have lunch because I still feel satisfied. One of the nice things about protein is that you feel satisfied for a long period of time. I'll head for the gym sometime this afternoon, and I'll come home and my wife is cooking kind of a roast that she found. So that'll be it for the day. Well, of course, I always start with I had broccoli and carrots and cauliflower along with my meal, and so did the children. And my wife as well. My wife lost 5 dress sizes when we started dating. My first wife passed away, unfortunately, after 48 years of marriage. And my current wife, my only, not my current wife, my wife, she'll kill me if he hears me say that, is lost 5 dress sizes as soon as we started going together and eating together. And
wow.
She's a marvel. She's
what type of exercise do you guys do? Because, you know, I mean, we could go to the gym and lift weights and things like that. But what did our Paleolithic ancestors do? I guess they ran things down. They escaped when things. But I would think that they would rest a lot. I know in your book that you talk about that they also kind of rested a lot and gazed up at the stars and kind of conserved their energy a little bit and did things in massive spurts. You know what? I hear the music. We're going to need to take an ID break.
All right.
And stay with us. We're interviewing Dr. Arthur Devani, and he's the author of The New Evolution Diet. Stay tuned right here to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z Show. We'll be right back. And welcome back to another edition again of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we're interviewing Dr. Arthur Devani. He's the author of The New Evolution Diet, and it's interesting, it's a Rodale book, and he says on the back cover, we humans evolved when food was scarce and life was full of arduous physical activity. Hence, our bodies instruct us to eat everything we can lay our hands on. I guess that is kind of was in Mother Nature back then, and to exert ourselves as little as possible. That's right, we're hardwired to be lazy overeaters. That was a perfect strategy for success thousands of years ago. We couldn't have survived. Our ancestors knew famine was close at hand. Feast now or suffer tomorrow. They were also careful to expend as little energy as possible because burning more calories than absolutely necessary was a threat to survival. In the modern world, the hunter-gatherer would follow these same principles. They'd eat a lot and move a little. That brings us to actually that point I was trying to make, and we're going to talk about kind of the types of exercise that you espouse in your book, The New Evolution Diet, and comments on that.
Paragraph you just read.
Yeah, that's on the back of your book. It's pretty interesting. Lazy overeaters. Come on.
It's true. The last time I was at Harvard, for example, I was amused at the worn paths in the grass that were full of shortcuts across the lawn.
Right. I think that's human nature to kind of
do those types of things. I agree
completely.
It's hardwired into us. So I treat exercise as play. Some is intense. The weightlifting is to give me the physiologic capacity, that is the capacity for, I call it metabolic headroom. You have a high limit on what you can do, say expressed in the number of METs you can produce.
I do martial arts.
Well, it's a perfect sort of...
And I guess I'm training to fight saber-toothed tigers and things like that.
Well, I don't know.
Or keeping my balance on a precipice. Learning balance so I don't fall to my death.
all true. And the quickness, you're developing some of your fast twitch muscle fibers there, which are completely neglected in most modern physiological models. The fast twitch fibers are the fountain of youth. They are furious fat burners in a heretofore unknown way, even though they don't rely on fat as their primary fuel. They, when they have to replenish their store of glucose, they metabolize fat.
So we should do, you know, wind sprints and fast. Tell us what types of exercise kind of we should be doing on the new evolution diet that you discuss in your book.
Well, pick a sport that is sort of what I call power law distributed, which means it's burst rest type of activity. Basketball and tennis are both of that form. I happen to play a fair amount of tennis. You run in sprints and then you stop and you're challenging your balance, depth perception, and your 3D view of the world, so to speak. Instead of being on a treadmill reading a book while you're
right, you're not engaged in it. But what about the mindfulness-based exercises like Tai Chi and yoga and things like that? They certainly have benefit. To us in flexibility and in calming our minds. You said ancient ancestors were kind of lazy and laid around a lot. Did they have time to rest their mind and things like that?
Oh, yeah. We have wonderful astronomical discoveries that are being found every day now, or not every day, but often, in terms of the amount of time they must have spent stargazing. By the way, stargazing was essential because it was navigation also. So they knew the world in a way we could never really come to grips with. By the way, we used their minds. We inherited our minds from them, and it's amazing how well a hunter-gatherer mind has adapted to the modern world. Really just astoundingly impressive in my view.
Yeah, but we're constantly in this day and age, as you know, in the last actually 20 years, you know, we're responding constantly to our emails. We're being constantly bombarded with information. And so it seems like we're moving away from the hunter-gatherer. Or really, is that part of the hunter-gatherer thing? Because we were always looking over our shoulder, wondering if we were going to be the next meal or what was our next meal.
That's exactly it. The unnoticed email now is like going across a trail and seeing fresh tracks that you better pay attention to.
Interesting.
We were very mindful.
So how come we're all suffering from adrenal burnout and things like that if our bodies are hardwired to deal with this stress? What's going on here? What's the disconnect in our...
Well, it's a difference between acute stress, which is adaptive. It brings adaptive responses, and chronic stress, which just burns us out.
I see.
They had virtually no chronic stress, except when they were facing a real episode of starvation, wherein they had to get up and move and find a new place to look for food. They had to have knowledge of 300-plus plants in order to know what they could eat during a period of time when they couldn't find the...
Oh, yeah. I meant to ask you, is there any... being, of course, a professor of botanical medicine at the university, I would love some references. Maybe you can email me some cool references of Paleolithic plants and any evidence that... I mean, I read books like Clan of the Cave Bear and things like that and see that they were using these things, and I see, you know, species that I'm trying to teach my own students to use as medicine, but do we have evidence that Paleolithic humans used herbs as medicine as well as food?
There may be evidence of that as well. Certainly, they had detailed knowledge of plants and mushrooms, which ones to eat, which ones to avoid, and so forth.
Yeah, I've heard that they found, things in the Neanderthal grave sites, burial sites, that seemed to be not, they weren't endemic to the area, so, which would imply that they carried plants mm-hmm. with them, and they had some type of a knowledge of medicine. And I know even in there's a concept called instinctual dowsing, where we watch animals, humans watch the animals, and we emulate kind of what they're doing. And I know I have a picture in my slideshow of a chimpanzee eating a plant with known antibiotic properties that normally they wouldn't eat, but they tend to eat it when they're sick, just like our cats and dogs know which grass to eat. It's fascinating.
Yes. It is fascinating. I know very little about that, except I can refer you to Lauren Cordain's book and his more scholarly writing, which will cover. He mentions 300.
Awesome.
As one of the numbers.
Yeah, send me his reference and I'll post it on our site or something like that. I'd appreciate that.
Yes. Great. He's a distinguished professor on Paleolithic nutrition and has done most of the key work in a lot of these areas. Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Yeah.
And it is true. There is this instinctual need. I mean, it's true also that some African tribes, the women will eat mud at a certain time of the year because probably they're lacking some minerals or other such things. Yeah, we have pretty good instincts, which we spend so much time trying to overcome. And our fear instincts, our threat to survival instincts seem to be challenged a great deal. And they're constantly mounting in preparation for escape or flight or fight. And that, that releases all kinds of stress hormones and degrades our muscle tissue, and a whole host of other inflammatory processes follow from that.
So it's the chronic stress we have to watch. The acute stress, that we're designed to deal with that, but we have to somehow insulate or protect ourselves from the chronic stress. So can we do that by living a Paleolithic existence? Will it fortify our bodies to protect us from the ravages of the free radicals that come about through chronic stress and the death hormones like cortisol and things like that?
Well, I must tell you, I take a patented form of glutathione, which I've taken for the last 30 years or so as well.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of glutathione as well, yeah.
Yes, and Dr. Demopoulos is a good friend of mine. He's the one who has the bioabsorbable form of glutathione. And many diseases today, for example, AIDS and diabetes, both exhaust the body's supply of glutathione and expose us to excess amounts of free radicals, which, of course, are released. One of the things, our immune system releases those to kill pathogens, but they can also damage our own body tissues. And then they steal electrons and they promote a cascade of free radicals.
So is the Paleolithic diet loaded with good antioxidants?
Yes, it is in the plants.
Right.
The phytochemicals in the plants are powerful detoxifiers. There are some antioxidants also, which are simply proteins in animal and fish foods. And then, of course, at the end of my book, I do tell people that I take glutathione and a few other things. For example, melatonin is also a pretty good free radical quencher. And it is hard to sleep, with the kind of world we live in, so periodically I will take a bit of melatonin. Although there are no tissue-specific antioxidants, they tend to migrate to the brain, and they protect the brain from free radical damage to a significant degree. Alzheimer's is probably a disease of free radical damage caused in the brain from a variety of things, including excess flows of glucose through the brain. Glucose promotes free radicals and glycation of proteins, which change.
Now, is it okay to get our carbohydrates from, a Paleolithic diet approach? I mean, we're thinking people are go the opposite way, where they consume like all meat and all protein, and they cut out most of the carbs. You know, South Beach diet, Dr. Atkins diet, all these other things like that. You're basically saying that, you know, you can get your carbs, but it has to be from what was around during the Paleolithic time, and agriculture came a lot later.
Well, that's certainly a good model, and it's my model. I let everybody, you know, pick their way through my model. I don't
right.
have one of these top-down control Soviet command and control models in mind. It fails. It fails in economies, and it fails. Our own body is just a big complex economy inside.
Hmm.
So yes, you get the primary source of carbohydrate in my diet is one, either like my liver converts amino acids into carbohydrate when needed to supply glucose to my brain.
Right.
Two, it's from plants, the structural carbohydrates, and you know, in plants are primarily, you know, in the membranes and what have you. So there's a substantial amount of healthy carbohydrate in the plants that I eat. I certainly do not have a super high protein, high fat, low carbohydrate diet. I just have virtually no simple carbohydrates and all plant based. By the way,
do you think the ancients ate honey and as maybe one of the simple carbohydrates? I just was curious if.
Episodically, hunter-gatherers will take great risks
to get bees, I know.
Yes, and those are African bees we're talking about in some cases, which are kind of lethal.
Yeah, so sugar back then was like such an
yes.
incredible risk and high that it was treated a little more precious than gold or platinum. You were saying something, Doctor.
Well, I was just pointing out that... Well, honey is full of all kinds of other things besides the glucose and fructose. So
yeah, there's like hormonal things in the royal jelly and all kinds of interesting.
Yeah,
nutrients.
Anything that's found in the natural world, even if rare. But the problem is when we can eat it every day.
Yes, that is it. That's always the key. Treat it like gold.
Mm-hmm. And I was pointing out that fat is the same thing. Fat would have been relatively rare, but much prized in the Paleolithic.
Right.
That's why they ate bone marrow and brain and other things to get at the fat. And they always waited for the animals to, you know, reach the prime amount of fat in them.
Interesting.
There's this thing called rabbit starvation, which is, you know, like some bodybuilders live, they eat so much protein, so little fat, and so little carbohydrate that their liver can't handle the toxic load of protein. You can't really eat protein in excess of 25% on a sustained basis without damaging your liver, I think.
Very interesting. Well, tell us where you can get your book and a little about your website as we close the program here, last couple minutes.
Well, my book is it's on Amazon and a variety of other sites. It's released in the UK and in Brazil and Germany and some other countries in those languages, even in Korea. Can you
believe
it? Wow,
very nice.
Sold it in Korea.
I know some Korean being trained in karate. Kamapsunada means thank you in Korean. I know some of it because
okay.
in training for my black belt, we have to know Korean.
Well, I had a lot of Korean students in my health class at the university before I retired, and they said, but I'm Asian, I have to eat rice.
yeah.
But I'll tell you what, I had people solve their autoimmune issues, their complexion problems, and what have you. Remember that the stomach is really the skin turned inside out.
Interesting. I like that comment.
Yeah. and so what affects your stomach to a large degree can affect your skin as well. And acne is just a sign of something going on inside the gut as well as...
Yeah. Big naturopathic believer in that. Well,
mm-hmm.
I certainly enjoyed having you on, and I've been actually following your diet for a while and can honestly say I feel a lot better. And so, again, that's the New Evolution Diet by Dr. Arthur Devaney, D-E, and then new word, V-A-N-Y, Ph.D. I advise reading it and trying this thing, especially if you just haven't been able to find anything to help you lose weight and get healthy. Why don't you give it a shot?
Thank you.
Thanks again, and we look forward to maybe having you on. And please remember to send me that reference on the 300 somewhat plants that the ancient ancient ancestors used. I'd really appreciate that for my own lectures.
You bet.
All right. Have a great new year. And
thank
that
you,
does it too. For another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Remember, you can contact us at naturalnurse.com and my website, drznaturally.com. That's drznaturally.com. And it was a pleasure to elucidate you. And stay healthy. Bye-bye, folks.